Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 695, Dancing Machine, Reflections on the Life and Death of Michael Jackson. This program is being recorded on October 24th of the year 2009. With this program, as is the case with virtually every For the Record program, using the SpitfireList.com website will be essential to your understanding. Using past broadcasts available on both audio file and in printed form will do much to flesh out the ancillary discussion to these broadcasts. Now, we're into Halloween season, and so I thought in keeping with same, we take a look at an individual for whom one might say every day was Halloween up to a point, namely the late pop icon Michael Jackson. When one moves past all of the frivolous nonsense that surrounded Michael Jackson, really that's redundant, there were some very interesting aspects to the latter part of his life and the circumstances surrounding his death, and in particular, some of the economic and political overtones to the disposition of his estate that I think are worth taking a look at. The late author Edith Wharton once said that, quote, "A frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys." And I think in many ways that applies to the Michael Jackson case. And we're going to take a look at what lay behind all of the enormous media hoo-ha surrounding Michael Jackson. I should say that due to the limitations of time, I haven't got time to editorialize about Michael Jackson. I had no use for the guy. I thought he was a freak. I thought he belonged in a zoo alongside Bubbles. But nonetheless, there are some very interesting aspects surrounding his late life and death and the political overtones to the disposition of his estate. Specifically, at the core of what we're going to be looking at concerns the enormous amount of money that is available because of the rights that Michael Jackson owned in joint partnership with Sony Music to a great many songs, including hundreds of Beatles songs. The licensing of the rights to those songs could generate a tremendous amount of money. Remember, vis-a-vis Sony, that Sony bought out BMG. Became a partner with BMG. Sony BMG, the former music arm of Bertelsmann, former publishing house for the SS, one of the largest media companies in the world, the largest English language publisher in the world, and to all available evidence, part of the Underground Reich. BMG was Bertelsmann's music arm. And we're going to be taking a look at Bertelsmann in this discussion. Now, when Michael Jackson was accused of pedophilia the second time, the Arvizo case, in order to generate capital to fund his defense, he basically sold off part of the rights to the Beatles songs to Sony BMG. And we're going to take a look at some of the people who were around Michael Jackson. But bear in mind that there's a tremendous amount of money tied up in the Jackson estate, and in particular with regard to licensing of song rights, Beatles songs in particular. And it is the money that really is part and parcel to the political overtones to Michael Jackson's late life and death. So, too, of very interesting, of great significance are some of the fascinating people around Michael Jackson. One of the people who was working as a consultant on his defense was none other than Gordon Novell, a veteran intelligence officer whose name crops up in connection with investigations ranging from the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy to Watergate to the DeLorean case. And that is a fellow named Gordon Novell, about whom we've spoken many times in the past. Also around Michael Jackson at the time of his death were not only members of the Nation of Islam, but also a very strange fellow named Dr. Tome Tome. Who exactly he is remains to be seen. He was a Lebanese businessman about whom very little else is known. And we're going to be taking a look at Michael Jackson's death, the extent to which he may have been deliberately pushed over the ledge, so to speak, basically driven to the point where he undoubtedly was going to experience some sort of fatal malfunction. And we're going to take a look at what is now taking place with regard to the maneuvering around the Beatles songs. We're going to open right up with part of an article from Vanity Fair's issue of July of 2005 called CSA Neverland. It's written by Maureen Orth, and it reads in part, skipping down, "Take General Maximo Overkill, for instance. That's his Soldier of Fortune's nom de guerre. His real name is Gordon Novell, and he moves in those spooky circles which he calls high strange, where conspiracies flourish and cloak and dagger investigations overlap. He cut his teeth working for former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison on the JFK assassination, and he boasts that he served as former Attorney General Ramsey Clark's Doberman at Waco. Several weeks before the trial began, I was put in touch with him through Steven Saltzman, the son of a James Bond film producer in Monaco, who told me that Michael Jackson's brother Germain had been seeking Novell's advice on how to stop the trial. According to Novell, the Jacksons believed that it was all a grand conspiracy, that the accuser's mother was being paid by Jackson's enemies, who wanted to take control of his major economic asset, the Sony ATV music catalog, which holds publishing rights to 251 Beatles songs and works by scores of other pop artists. Jackson claimed that the main conspirators were Sony Records, its former president Tommy Mottola, and Santa Barbara County District Attorney Tom Sneeden, the prosecutor who also investigated Jackson in 1993. The catalog is held jointly by Jackson and Sony, and Jackson's share is mortgaged for more than $200 million. If Jackson defaults, Sony has first chance to buy his half as early as this coming December. A Sony spokesperson said, quote, "We're not going to comment on any aspect of this," unquote. Jackson explained to Novell that the conspirators had introduced him to Al Malnick, a wealthy Miami attorney who had once represented Meyer Lansky. Malnick later helped Jackson refinance his loans. That was not what Jackson told Novell, however. According to Novell, Jackson said he was lured to Malnick's house in Miami by film director Brett Ratner to see a house so beautiful it would make him catatonic. He said that once he was there, however, Malnick, who Jackson claimed had mafia ties, wanted to put his fingers in the singer's business. Jackson also said he received a call from Tommy Mottola while he was there, which aroused his suspicion, but he did not tell Novell that he later put Malnick on the board of the Sony ATV Music Partnership. Reached by telephone, Malnick scoffed at the idea of a conspiracy or of his having any mafia ties. He said, quote, "It doesn't make any sense," unquote. Ratner confirmed that he took Jackson to Malnick's house and that he considers Malnick a father figure. Jackson and Mottola have been at odds for years. In New York in July of 2002, Jackson staged a public protest against Mottola with the Reverend Al Sharpton calling him a racist and very, very devilish, unquote. He called for a boycott of Sony, which is believed to have contributed to Mottola's ouster from the company 6 months later. Jackson is reportedly so frightened of Mottola that one of the reasons he surrounded himself with Nation of Islam guards in 2003 was that he thought Mottola could put out a hit on him. Mottola could not be reached for comment. Jackson wanted Novell to find the links among these characters. Novell told me in March that he believes he'll get convicted. He believes the judge, the DA, and the Sony guys are in a conspiracy to take over his money, unquote. And skipping down, apparently those suspicions have been voiced by Michael Jackson to, among others, Al Sharpton, and also to the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And skipping down, Novell told me they had discussed the conspiracy at length on the phone. In the interview, Jesse Jackson asked Michael point blank about the catalog and what was in it. Michael said that, quote, "It's a huge catalog. It's very valuable. It's worth a lot of money, and there is a big fight going on right now as we speak about that," unquote. He added, again quoting, "I can't comment on it. There's a lot of conspiracy. I'll say that much," unquote. So, again, one of the things that is central to the whole Michael Jackson issue here, and that is, again, not only his financial problems, as we'll see in a minute, but the fact that he had, along with Sony, the rights to a whole bunch of Beatles songs as well as other music, and that was very, very valuable indeed. And he had basically brought Sony in on that in order to help finance his defense in the Arvizo case. Now, Gordon Novell was brought in as a consultant on this case, and Gordon Novell claims that Michael Jackson stiffed him on his consultant's fee. All of this raises more questions than it answers. Gordon Novell is a very formidable individual and also a very well-connected individual, also a very enigmatic individual. And certainly having him at the foundation of Michael Jackson's defense, at least for a period of time, certainly raises questions about just what Michael Jackson, I personally wouldn't necessarily have Gordon Novell as an advisor on something like that. You never know. Novell is not somebody you want to trifle with. And who knows just at what point he might decide to go double operative on something like that. I'm not saying he was, but it's just interesting that at this time, one of the interesting folks around Michael Jackson was the enigmatic and formidable Gordon Novell. But that's by no means the all of the story or even most of the story. There were many other interesting characters around Michael Jackson at the same time. I would note in this context, Gordon Novell told Michael Jackson to sort of clean up his weird image, that he looked like a pedophile, and that certainly made any sort of public relations or criminal defense that much more difficult. I personally think that's pretty good advice. And also the indications here are that Gordon Novell seemed to believe a lot of the Jackson family theories about conspiracy concerning doing in Michael Jackson and getting a hold of that catalog. I think there may very well have been a substance to those fears, and we're going to see basically what has happened right after Michael Jackson's death with regard to the maneuvering to the rights to songs and also the licensing rights to songs and also some speculation about the Beatles catalog in particular. We're going to take a look now at some of the interesting elements around Michael Jackson at the end of his life, not Gordon Novell, who was serving as a defense consultant when he was going through his pedophilia case, but we're going to take a look at members of the Nation of Islam who were around him, and then inside two of this program, we're going to review Alvin Malnick, the Alvin of Arabia, whom we've spoken about in connection with the South Florida criminal milieu that overlaps the flight schools at which some of the 9/11 hijackers trained. But we're going to take a look now at Michael Jackson's physical condition, because according apparently to people around him, Michael Jackson was in no position to even consider a 50-concert tour. He might not have been able to sing at all. He could barely dance. And there were indications that any such tour would have certainly killed him. The question is, was that the idea? And again, let's take a look at some of the people around him. We're going to turn now to an article from the Mail Online. That's the British Daily Mail. This is from the Mail Online's issue of June 29th of 2009. It's an article by Ian Halperin. And Ian Halperin here has written a book about Michael Jackson. This article is headlined, "I'm Better Off Dead, I'm Done," unquote. Michael Jackson's fateful prediction just a week before his death. The article reads in part as follows. Whatever the final autopsy results reveal, it was greed that killed Michael Jackson. Had he not been driven by a cabal of bankers, agents, doctors, and advisors to commit to the grueling 50 concerts in London's O2 Arena, I believe he would still be alive today. During the last weeks and months of his life, Jackson made desperate attempts to prepare for the concert series scheduled for next month, a series that would have earned millions for the singer and his entourage, but which he could never have completed, not mentally and not physically. Michael knew it, and his advisors knew it. Anyone who caught even a fleeting glimpse of the frail old man hiding beneath the costumes and cosmetics would have understood that the London tour was madness. For Michael Jackson, it was fatal. I had more than a glimpse of the real Michael. As an award-winning freelance journalist and filmmaker, I spent more than 5 years inside his camp. Many in his entourage spoke frankly to me, and that made it possible for me to write authoritatively last December that Michael had 6 months to live, a claim that, at the time, his official spokesman, Dr. Tomei, called a, quote, complete fabrication, unquote. The singer, he told the world, was in fine health, unquote. 6 months and one day later, Jackson was dead. Some like to snigger at his public image, and it's true that flamboyant clothes and bizarre makeup made for a comic grotesque. Yet without them, his appearance was distressing, with skin blemishes, thinning hair, and discolored fingernails. I had established beyond doubt, for example, that Jackson relied on an extensive collection of wigs to hide his graying hair. Shorn of their luxuriance, the Peter Pan of Neverland cut a skeletal figure indeed. It was clear that he was in no condition to do a single concert, let alone 50. He could no longer sing, for a start. Some days he could barely talk. He could no longer dance. Disaster was looming in London, and in the opinion of his closest confidants, he was feeling suicidal as well. To understand why a singer of Jackson's fragility would even think about traveling to London, we need to go back to June 13, 2005, when my involvement in his story began. Now, bear in mind, that is exactly when the Vanity Fair article was written. The Vanity Fair article was written in July of 2005, 1 month later. Continuing with this story, Ian Halpern writes, "As a breaking news alert flashed on CNN announcing that the jury had reached a verdict in Jackson's trial for allegedly molesting 13-year-old Gavin Arvizo at his Neverland Ranch in California, I knew that history had been made, but that Michael Jackson had been broken, irrevocably so, as it proved. Nor was it the first time that Michael had been accused of impropriety with young boys. Little more than a decade earlier, another 13-year-old Jordan Chandler made similar accusations in a case that was eventually settled before trial, but not before the damage had been done to Jackson's reputation. Michael had not helped this case. Appearing in a documentary with British broadcaster Martin Bashir, he not only admitted that he liked to share a bed with teenagers, mainly boys in pajamas, but showed no sign of understanding why anybody might be legitimately concerned. I had started my investigation convinced that Jackson was guilty. By the end, I no longer believed that. I could not find a single shred of evidence suggesting that Jackson had molested a child, but I had found significant evidence demonstrating that most, if not all, of his accusers lacked credibility and were motivated primarily by money." Bear in mind, breaking in here, it was those accusations that led Michael Jackson to partner up with Sony BMG on the rights to the Beatles songs, and that was at the core of this conspiracy theory that the Jacksons had and some of the members of his camp had, and that I think may very well have had some substance, and at least some substance to it, and we're going to take a look at who might have been that substance later in this program. Continuing. "Jackson also deserved much of the blame, of course, continuing to share a bed with children even after the suspicion surfaced bordered on criminal stupidity. He was also playing a truly dangerous game. It's clear to me that Michael was homosexual and that his taste was for young men, albeit not as young as Jordan Chandler or Gavin Arvizo. In the course of my investigations, I spoke to two of his gay lovers, one a Hollywood waiter and the other an aspiring actor. The waiter had remained friends, perhaps more with the singer, until his death last week. He had served Jackson at a restaurant. Jackson made his interest plain, and the two slept together the following night. According to the waiter, Jackson fell in love. The actor, who has been given solid but uninspiring film parts, saw Jackson in the middle of 2007. He told me they had spent nearly every night together during their affair, an easy claim to make, you might think. But this lover produced corroboration in the form of photographs of the two of them together and a witness. Other witnesses speak of strings of young men visiting his house at all hours, even in the period of his decline. Some stayed overnight. When Jackson lived in Las Vegas, one of his closest aides told how he would sneak off to a grungy, rat-infested motel, often dressed as a woman to disguise his identity, to meet a male construction worker he'd fallen in love with. Jackson was acquitted in the Arvizo case, dramatically so, but the effect on his mental state was ruinous. Sources close to him suggest he was close to a complete nervous breakdown. The ordeal had left him physically shattered as well. One of my sources suggested that he might already have had a genetic condition I had never previously come across called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, the lack of a protein that can help protect the lungs. Although up to 100,000 Americans are severely affected by it, it is an under-recognized condition. Michael was receiving regular injections of alpha-1 antitrypsin derived from human plasma. The treatment is said to be remarkably effective and can enable the sufferer to lead a normal life. But the disease can cause respiratory problems and, in severe cases, emphysema. Could this be why Jackson had for years been wearing a surgical mask in public to protect his lungs from the ravages of the disease, or why from time to time he resorted to a wheelchair? When I returned to my source inside the Jackson camp for confirmation, he said, "Yeah, that's what he's got. He's in bad shape. They're worried that he might need a lung transplant, but that he might be too weak to get one. Some days he can hardly see, and he's having a lot of trouble walking," unquote. Even Michael Jackson's legendary wealth was in sharp decline. Just a few days before he announced his 50-concert comeback at the O2 Arena, one of my sources told me Jackson had been offered £1.8 million to perform at a party for a Russian billionaire on the Black Sea. Is he up to it, he asked? I had asked? He has no choice. He needs the money. His people are pushing him hard, said the source. Could he even stand on a stage for an hour concert? He can stand. The treatments have been successful. He can even dance once he gets in better shape. He just can't sing, said the aide, adding that Jackson would have to limp sync to get through the performance. Quote, nobody will care, just as long as he moonwalks, unquote. He also revealed Jackson had been offered well over £60 million to play Las Vegas for 6 months. He said no, but his people are trying to force it on him. He said he's that close to losing everything, said the source. And again, we're going to see who his people are in just a second. After discussing the fact that Michael Jackson, following their Aviso trial, wound up in hock to a Bahraini sheik, which is interesting in and of itself, because after the Aviso trial, a bunch of people, either of Arab and or Muslim, either of Arab extraction, Muslim religious persuasion, turn up in Michael Jackson's environment. His security was largely being handled by the Nation of Islam, and as we're going to see, or as we're seeing here, a Bahraini sheik had much to do with paying his expenses in the wake of the Arvizo trial. But later, Michael Jackson said that he thought it was charity, or basically it was a gift on the part of the Bahraini sheik, who then sued Michael Jackson. Whether this had more to do with driving Jackson to the tour, it remains to be seen. But as we're going to see, the very Alvin Malnick, whom Michael Jackson correctly suspected of having is himself the Alvin of Arabia alluded to in For the Record 512. His son married into the Saudi royal family and converted to Islam, as did, I think, also did Alvin Malnick. But in any event, Alvin Malnick himself, in addition to the Lansky connection, the Lansky syndicate connection, also is connected now to the Saudi royal family, as well as to a lot of other people as well. Now, more about Jackson's debts to the sheik and the Bahraini sheik, and also the Beatles catalog, skipping down in this article. Although Jackson settled with the sheik on the eve of the trial that would have aired his financial dirty laundry, that much deeper into the hole. That's the settlement vis-a-vis the Bahraini sheik. A hole that kept getting bigger, but that was guaranteed by Jackson's half-ownership of the copyrights to the Beatles catalog. He owned them in a joint venture with record company Sony, which has kept him from bankruptcy. Jackson is in hock to Sony for hundreds of millions, a source told him a couple of months ago. No bank will give him any money, so Sony has been paying his bills. The trouble is that he hasn't been meeting his obligations. Sony has been in a position for more than a year where it can repossess Michael's share of the Beatles catalog. That's always been Sony's dream scenario, full ownership. But they don't clash with it as they're afraid of a backlash from his fans. Their nightmare is an organized boycott Sony movement worldwide, which could prove hugely costly. It is the only thing standing between Michael and bankruptcy. And skipping down of the people who were around him at the time, these, after all, were not the handlers who had seen him through the aftermath of the Arvizo trial and who had been protecting his fragile emotional health to the best of their ability. They were gone, and a new set of advisors was in place. The clear-out had apparently been engineered by his children's nanny, Grace Warawamba, who was gaining considerable influence over Jackson and his affairs, and has been described as, quote, the queen bee by those around Jackson. Warawamba had ties to the black militant organization, the Nation of Islam, and its controversial leader, Louis Farrakhan, whom she enlisted for help in running Jackson's affairs. Before long, the Nation was supplying Jackson's security detail, and Farrakhan's son-in-law, Leonard Mohammed, was appointed as Jackson's business manager, though his role has lessened significantly in recent years. In late 2008, a shadowy figure who called himself Dr. Tome Tome suddenly emerged as Jackson's, quote, official spokesman, unquote. Tome has been alternately described as a Saudi Arabian billionaire and as an orthopedic surgeon, but he is actually a Lebanese businessman who does not have a medical license. At one point, Tome claimed he was an ambassador at large for Senegal, but the Senegalese embassy said they had never heard of him. Tomei's own ties to the Nation of Islam came to light in March of 2009 when New York auctioneer Darren Julian was conducting an auction of Michael Jackson memorabilia. Julian had filed an affidavit in Los Angeles Superior Court that month in which he described a meeting he had with Tomei's business partner, James R. Weller. According to Julian's account, Weller said if we refused to post her from, quote, we were in danger from, quote, Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Those people are very protective of Michael. Well, as we looked at in For the Record program number 21, there are serious questions about Louis Farrakhan, or Louis X, as he was calling himself then, and the assassination of Malcolm X, the man whose mantle he has assumed. Again, For the Record 21, available on the Spitfire website, is a very good way to check that out. Now we're going to jump ahead. Michael Jackson, of course, died, and we're going to, on the description for the Record 695, you'll be able to view that entire Mail Online article, and it's very clear around Michael Jackson, people who were around Michael Jackson and who were pushing him actively to undertake that 50-concert tour were basically pushing him to his death. There was no way he was going to survive. Of course, there is now a murder investigation underway into his death. The San Jose Mercury of Friday, July 17th of 2009 has an article about that. Police say Jackson's death being treated as homicide. And basically, there is now a homicide investigation into the death of Michael Jackson. But let's take a look at what else has happened right after his death. And by the way, note that in the late summer and early fall, a whole lot of Beatles songs became available either on CD or online, whether there's any connection between that and the death of Michael Jackson. I don't know who's profiting from it, but somebody sure as bloody hell is. Let's take a look at another interesting thing that happened in the wake of Michael Jackson's death in late June of 2009. Following is from the New York Times of July 9th of 2009 by Carter Doherty. Bertelsmann re-enters music world with KKR. Less than a year after Bertelsmann, the German media giant exited the music business, it is taking a novel approach to get back in. The company said Wednesday that it would form a joint venture with the private equity firm Robertson Company to license and administer music rights. The new company will combine Bertelsmann's existing BMG rights management unit with the financial muscle of KKR, which will own 51% of the joint venture, with Bertelsmann holding the rest. And then in the page right opposite that, in that same edition of the New York Times, July 9th of 2009, again, Jackson died right at the end of June. This is called Partners Fancy a Trove of Songs. To Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, music was, quote, the universal language of mankind, unquote. Money may be the thing private equity firm partners at the private equity firm Kohlberg Kravis Roberts. Skipping down. Though Bertelsmann sold its music business last year, some of his executives stayed on, and Bertelsmann has kept some of its music rights. So the venture has the skill to build a rights business. Now it also has the cash. KKR is contributing 50 million euros for a 51% stake and has earmarked another 200 million euros for future acquisitions. That's not enough to gobble up the Beatles library, but the competitors for such trophies, struggling, the venture has a shot at a piece of the action. And specifically what they were talking about here, the fund run by Henry Kravis is teaming up with the German media group Bertelsmann to pounce on some of the choicest bits of the music business copyrights to songs. Given the turbulence of the recorded music sector and the ownership of libraries like Michael Jackson's up in the air, they'll likely have a wealth of assets from which to choose. So it's the Beatles and Jackson's estate that are one of the focal points of this deal. Bertelsmann, publisher for the SS, and to all indications, a currently functioning arm of the Underground Reich. And inside two of this program, we're going to take a look at Alvin Malnick, a.k.a. Side 1. Yeah, but that concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 695, Dancing Machine Reflections on the Life and Death of Michael Jackson. This is being recorded on October 24th of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Happy Halloween.